From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Ken Tucker, filling in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, poet and novelist Michael Ondaatje, the author of The English Patient, has a new book of poems called Handwriting. He talks about his native Sri Lanka, the literary life in Canada, and how he uses Van Morrison in his poetry. Also, Mark Linkous, leader of the rock band Sparkle Horse. Linkous survived a near-fatal accidental overdose to create a glowing new album, Good Morning Spider. And in part two of our look at Duke Ellington, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead tells us how Ellington and his soloists inspired each other. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Ken Tucker, critic at large for Entertainment Weekly, sitting in for Terry Gross. My guest, Michael Ondaatje, is probably best known as the author of the novel The English Patient, which was made into a rather popular film a few years ago. But Ondaatje has actually published more books of poetry than fiction and has a new collection just out called Handwriting. Ondaatje was born in 1943 in Ceylon, now called Sri Lanka, an island at the southern tip of India. One of his books is a nonfiction account of his parents' lives there called Running in the Family. When he was 19, he moved to Canada with his mother, where he's lived ever since. Newsweek once described Michael Ondaatje as looking like a cross between Paul Newman and Zeus, and to continue that metaphor on my own, he writes like a god who's also a hustler, always leading you in one direction while arriving at a different, pleasantly unexpected place. I asked him to begin by reading the first poem in his new collection, A Gentleman Compares His Virtue to a Piece of Jade.
The enemy was always identified in art by a lion. And in our book of victories, wherever you saw a parasol on the battlefield, you could identify the king within its shadow. We began with myths and later included actual events. There were new professions, cormorant girls who screamed on prawn farms to scare birds, stilt walkers, tightrope walkers. There was always the untaught hold by which the master defeated the pupil who challenged him. Palanquins carried the weapons of a goddess. Bamboo tubes cut in 17th century Japan we used as poem holders. We tied bells onto falcons. A silted water garden in Mihinthalay, the letter M, the word thereby. There were wild cursive scripts. There was the two-dimensional tradition. Solitaries spent all their years writing one good book. Federico Tessio graced us with Breeding the Racehorse. In our theaters, human beings wondrously became other human beings. Bangles from Polonnaruwa, a nine-chambered box from Gampola, the archaeology of kettlebells. We believed in the intimate life and inner self. A libertine was one who made love before nightfall, or without darkening the room. Walking the Alhambra blindfolded, to be conscious of the sound of water, your hand could feel it coursing down banisters. We aligned our public holidays with the full moon, 3 a.m. in temples, the hour of washing the gods, the formalization of the vernacular. The Buddha's left foot shifted at the moment of death. That great writer, dying, called out for the fictional doctor in his novels. That tightrope walker from Kurunagala, the generator shut down by insurgents, stood there, swaying in the darkness above us.
Thank you. When you write lines like, we tied bells onto falcons, we aligned our public holidays with the full moon, who's the we in that poem?
Well, one of the ways I attempted to write this very informal and personal history of a country where I was born was to take on a voice of we as a populace, as a not a royal we, but a human we that sort of moves from ancient to modern or ancient to contemporary almost. So in a way, a poem like that is a kind of history of a culture that's no longer available to a people. So, I mean, it does move from a kind of a more mythical situation to real events.
The poems in this book, more than many of your earlier ones that I've read, deal very specifically with images and ideas of Sri Lanka or the Ceylon that you remember. Mm-hmm. Is there a reason for this emphasis at this point in writing this book?
Well, I think in a way the book I wrote before about Sri Lanka, which was called Running in the Family, which was about really about my family, my father and mother's generation and my grandparents' generation, was in a way a kind of society that seemed to be very cut off from the rest of the country. You know, I mean, they were kind of, if not an elite, they were not very conscious politically. And I've been going back to Sri Lanka a lot in the last few years, and one of the things I wanted to do was write outside the family, to write about the country in different aspects. So the tone is definitely very different, and I didn't want to, you know, retreat back and write a Running in the Family Part 2, so I wanted to write more about a country that's going through a very tragic phase.
In what sense?
Well, in the sense that it is has been in a state of war for the last since about 1983, mm-hmm. and you know, it has a country that's tragically caught up in a racial, political, religious war that seems almost not that it cannot solve, not that one can solve these things, but that they, from a Western point of view, we always think we can solve political situations in other countries. And here it's, you know, it seems to be a kind of torment that one cannot end this war.
You wrote in that memoir, Running in the Family, that your parents went from being, quote, two of the best known and wealthiest families in Ceylon to my father owning a chicken farm and my mother managing a hotel. Mm-hmm. How did that happen?
Well, I mean, the problem there was my father was a very serious drinker, of mythic proportions, as I heard it. And, I mean, he lost all his money and then as a result of that lost his jobs and ended up on a farm that his father had owned. And so it was a very different kind of world that he ended up in. And my mother, after they divorced, moved to England and got a job in England. So the family kind of split up at that point. And
how old were you at that point?
I guess I was about 5 or 6 when they broke up. Uh-huh. And, you know, when I was 11, I went to England to go to school, which was a sort of tradition, of a kind of middle-class tradition. If, you know, if you could afford it, you sent your kids to school in England, and then they would eventually come back after getting their Oxford Blue or Cambridge Blue or something like that, ideally. Mm-hmm. And I was, I suppose, of the generation that did not come back. I had a brother who did not come back and a sister who did not come back. But I do have another sister in Sri Lanka who still is there and who obviously I'm very close to.
Did you ever feel, after you'd grown and begun a career in Canada, that you were a writer in exile?
Well, in the sense that I hadn't really dealt with my past in Sri Lanka, I suppose I hadn't. And during the time when I first started to write poetry, which was poetry about the landscape I was living in, which was Canada at that time, I did feel separate in some ways. And it took a while for me to be able to write about my own family. You know, it was about my third or fourth book of prose that I did attempt to write Running in the Family. And but in a way, I do keep, I have gone back to write about Sri Lanka in this last book. And, you know, I probably will with other ones as well, because it is very much a part of my background. And in a way, the literature hasn't been spoken as much as you know, obviously in other countries. I mean, when I was writing Running the Family, what was very sad was that there was very little written text that I could find, you know, even to the point where people didn't keep diaries or keep journals. And the only histories that existed were kind of memoirs by viscounts or something like that who were there when the English were there.
Why would that be?
I think that was because, essentially, you know, the energy of story, which certainly exists in Sri Lanka, is an oral one. You know, and I think, you know, I mean, if I sat down to a meal, I could get the most fantastic stories, mm-hmm. Told to me by uncles and aunts and about anything at all. And these were, this is actually, in a way, Running in the Family was an attempt to try and kind of tell those stories in a literary way, to tell them within a book. And but there was never a sense that people could sit down and write a novel. And I think that was quite a new thing in some ways.
So did you begin your career as a poet, or did you, when you professionally began a career, were you wanting to be a poet, or did you write prose?
Oh, I wanted to be a poet. I never thought of being a writer until I came to Canada. And, you know, I think it would have been seen to be presumptuous or something. I'm not quite sure what it was. But when I came to Canada when I was 19, I met other writers of my own age, and I began to write. And what I wrote for the first 5 or 6 years was poetry. It wasn't until I wrote a book called The Collected Works of Billy the Kid that I started to include prose within that book. And then from then on, I have written, I guess, 3 novels now and a memoir.
The Collected Works of Billy the Kid is just wonderful. It's one of my favorite of your books. It's more like a novel in the form of a collection of prose poems to me. Mm-hmm. And it struck me that your prose is often very poetic, and a lot of your poetry has a very prosy conversational tone. Mm-hmm. Has this occurred to you?
Well, I mean, I suppose I'm conscious of the difference, but I mean, I think I like to kind of erase the boundaries between genres, whether it's prose and poetry or prose and imaginary interviews or whatever. You know, I mean, I think in a way, when I was making The Collected Works of Billy the Kid, I saw the thing not so much as a book as a huge wall of collage or something, you know, like a fresco where I could kind of repeat stories which had started off as poems, to see them in terms of prose or picture, or if I could have had sound, I would have had sound. Mm-hmm. You know, in a way, it was sort of a frustrated film as well. I wanted to make my Western movie, and I couldn't. And so I made it within the form of a book.
It seems as if you're often attracted to figures of popular myth or popular culture, that the Billy the Kid, another of your books, Coming Through Slaughter, was a novel about the jazz musician Buddy Bolden. Mm-hmm. What is it about these figures that it wouldn't automatically occur, I think, to think that a poet from Sri Lanka would be drawn to such subjects?
Well, it's very strange. I mean, when I was a kid in Sri Lanka, we all played cowboys and Indians. I mean, it sounds appallingly bad, you know, taste and you know, absurd politically and socially. But I mean, I'm afraid that existed and it still existed. It's like, you know, genes being the most important thing in European countries, you know. So that was, I guess, the start of it. But I mean, I think I've always been, as a writer, interested in history as much as in writing. And the figures of Billy the Kid, the figures of Bolden were interesting to me in the sense that because they existed in reality, when I began the book, I could in fact do research, I could inquire, and curiosity was the most important thing I needed when I was writing a book. You know, and so I tended to write about things I didn't know when I began the book, so I would learn those as I went along. Mm-hmm. So I was learning about politics of range wars and Billy the Kid, or the politics of immigration, when I wrote a book called In the Skin of a Lion. Mm-hmm. And I had always also been interested in jazz. So, I mean, jazz was my great passion. I mean, I've said before, the person I really wanted to be was Fats Waller all my life. And as I couldn't play the piano and as I couldn't be Fats Waller, I wanted to write my jazz story, you know. So that's how that began. Mm-hmm. But I love the act of starting off with an historical moment or a historical person and trying to discover that person over a period of 3 or 4 years when you're writing a book, to try and catch and, you know, not that you ever catch a person historically, but to try and kind of create, in fact, a portrait of that person by improvisation, I suppose.
My guest is Michael Ondaatje. We'll be back after a short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is poet and novelist Michael Ondaatje. He has a new collection of poetry out called Handwriting. In the middle of this new book, you have a section called The Nine Sentiments. I want to ask you to read one section from this long poem, but first, could you explain what the nine sentiments are?
Well, I mean, it's a very abstract term, actually, but I think essentially it is a way of, in love poetry, of rather than writing poems specifically about a person, to talk about aspects of love, to talk about stages of love. I mean, if one studied Indian love poetry very carefully, every time one talked about a certain location, whether it was a beach or a forest or a desert or a stone field, those would start to signal moments of emotion or kinds of emotion in a love story. So that there tended to be various stages of a love relationship, from joy and passion to disturbance to unhappiness to some kind of resolution. So the nine sentiments is really to try and catch aspects of love at various times. And maybe I should read one or two of those.
Yes, please. Sentiments. Thank you.
The pepper vine shaken and shaken like someone in love. Leaf patterns. Saffron and panic seed on the lower pillows where their breath met. While she loosened from her hips the string with three calling bells. Her fearless heart, light as a barn owl, against him all night. In another section, an old book on the poisons of madness, a map of forest monasteries, a chronicle brought across the sea in Sanskrit slokas. I hold all these, but you have become a ghost for me. I hold only your shadow since those days I drove your nature away, a falcon who became a coward. I hold you the way astronomers draw constellations for each other in the markets of wisdom, placing shells on a dark blanket, saying, these are the heavens, calculating the movement of the great stars.
Those are really lovely, very sensuous lyric poems. I noticed that in the acknowledgments to the nine sentiments, you say you quote a line from Van Morrison's song, Cypress Avenue.
Right.
I love that song, but I must admit I haven't been able to pick out the line.
The line is, I think, conquered on a car seat.
Uh-huh.
No, but I don't know which poem that is, and I've forgotten which one it is.
I also noticed that in your 1984 book of poems called Secular Love, you refer to another Van Morrison song, Madam George.
Right. Actually, I think, you know, that two or three regular characters in all my books, one is Fats Waller, one is has become Van Morrison. I noticed the book I'm working on right now, there's some other reference to Van Morrison.
Really?
And I think when I met Anthony Minghella, who was making the film of English Patient, I said, the only person I want you to cast is Van Morrison in some small role so I could meet him. And he's as big a fan as I am, in fact, more so. But I guess in the excitement of making the film, he forgot. I thought he would be a good ambulance driver or something.
A good grouchy one.
Yes.
Well, since you've mentioned The English Patient, I have to ask you whether the making of that book into what became such a big commercial hit, did it alter your literary life in any kind of significant way? I imagine it must have thrust you into a kind of prominence you hadn't had before.
Well, you know, Canadians, living in Canada, it's a bit easier than living in the States, I suspect. You know, but no, I mean, I guess what I enjoyed about that process was that I did meet people who worked on the film who I admired a great deal, you know, whether they were actors or the director or, you know, someone like Walter Murch, who was the sound editor, who I'd always admired as an editor. And, I mean, I took it as an event where I was going to learn something, learn about the process of filmmaking and learn about editing, which has always interested me.
Mm-hmm.
And so, I mean, that certainly did change my profile. But the important thing, I guess, was kind of hide back and work on another book.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's get back to your poetry. I wonder if you could read the short poem that's on page 19 of your book called The First Rule of Sinhalese Architecture.
Mm-hmm. Never build three doors in a straight line. A devil might rush through them deep into your house, into your life.
Is this a rule you've actually heard, or one you made up?
No, it's what I heard. I mean, I think a lot of this book is in fact made up, in the sense that it's things I've heard and listened to and heard, you know, and discovered in my various journeys and visits in Sri Lanka. I mean, whether it's an old a myth of how one feeds a sick child, or how one, you know, avoids certain fears such as this one, or how or, you know, in the first poem I read about a gentleman compares his virtue to a piece of jade, all those images, in fact, do come out of events, to most of them, in terms of Sri Lanka. So that if you look at the statue of a Buddha before his death, you see that the left foot is not quite next to the right foot. And this is because that his left foot does shift at the moment of death. So small images like this make up larger stories in the poems.
I wonder, have you ever written in imitation of other poets you admire, or worked in forms that interest you as kind of formal disciplines or exercises, sonnets or, you know, things like that?
No, that's interesting. I haven't. I guess, you know, I suppose when I read a poet or a novelist that I'm very fond of, I don't read them to learn, you know, or I'm sure I'm learning from them, you know, the way one learns from anything good and also learns bad things from something bad. I do learn from them, but for me, it is a kind of unconscious education. You know, so that if I'm reading a novel by DeLillo or someone else, I can. It is for me the pleasure of the text, the pleasure of being in that world of that novel, and is, you know, I'm sure that the influences are there, not necessarily by him but by the writers. But I don't set out to try and write in the pattern of DeLillo or Hemingway or whoever it is, mm-hmm. though I might like them. I think that, you know, makes me feel that I am wearing a mask. And I think, you know, the act of writing for me is such a private one, and such a one of difficulty, and one of almost reconnaissance, of trying to find something in a dark room, that the last thing on my mind is, perhaps I can find this by putting on the clothes of a writer I admire. Mm-hmm. So it is a very private thing, but I'm sure those influences are there, you know. And it's not just writers, too. It's painters or photographers or, you know, swimmers that would influence, you know, a writer, I think.
Mm-hmm. Michael Ondaatje, I'd like to thank you for talking with me today.
Thank you.
Michael Ondaatje, his new book of poems is called Handwriting. I'm Ken Tucker. This is Fresh Air.
Right now, All-American number one saxophonist Johnny Hodges returns in an identifying medley.
Coming up, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead takes a look at the relationship between Duke Ellington and his soloists. Also, Sparkle Horse. It's the name of a rock group, but it's primarily a one-man band consisting of Mark Linkus, his imagination, and a lot of artful overdubbing. This is Fresh Air. I'm Ken Tucker. My guest, Mark Linkus, is the man behind Sparkle Horse, a rock band for which he writes, sings, and plays nearly all the music. Since the release of Sparkle Horse's 1995 debut called Viva Dixie Submarine Transmission Plot, Linkus has been hailed for making lushly textured, invitingly elusive rock music. His new Sparkle Horse album, called Good Morning Spider, has arrived with another layer of interest, since a few of its songs refer to a 1996 accidental overdose. Linkus has been out on tour to promote Good Morning Spider. Here's a bit from the album called Pain Birds.
Goddamn.
That song, Pain Birds, contains a sound that I think is very characteristic of a lot of your songs that includes that sort of electronically distorted version of your voice. I noticed when I went to that Sparkle Horse show the other night that your mic stand has two microphones, one that kind of projects your normal singing voice and the other that filters it through some kind of distorting effect. What do you like about that sound?
There's some type of documentary feel to it. I don't really know orally why I like it so much, but it seems to make the proximity of a voice seem a lot closer to your ear, and also that old radio the Green Hornet sound. That's just, I started at first trying to disguise my voice because I didn't like it, but now I've gotten to really just use it as another instrument.
What didn't you like about your voice?
I don't know. I think just the way lots of people just can't stand to hear themselves on tape. But I don't use it specifically for sabotage anymore.
No.
It makes it fit well into the song sometimes, I think.
Well, in that in this song, Happy Man, that whole, what you were saying about the idea of the radio, Happy Man kind of it's almost like tuning in a radio station. The song kind of fades in and out, and you get a lot of static. Were you going for that kind of effect?
No, that was mostly just sabotage, because I was afraid that song would be used as, tried to be pushed as a single.
Uh-huh.
And I would much rather something like Pain Birds be a single.
Uh-huh. As you mean by your record company?
Yeah.
For them to pick that song because it had like an obviously very catchy melody or...
Yeah, and plus I was really tired. It's an old song.
Uh-huh.
That song was recorded before the first album ever came out.
Uh-huh.
And plus I didn't want to skip over it when I listened to the record, so doing all the radio static made it more interesting for me to listen to.
Uh-huh. I think we should hear a little bit of that song.
Yeah.
Give an example of what we're talking about.
If we okay. Could.
If I had more would be laid at your feet. Would you give me just a little smile? The dogs on the trail wouldn't drag me back to jail.
That's A Happy Man from Good Morning Spider. Let's talk, if you will, about this accident that occurred in 1995 that seems to shape a lot of the content of your new CD. You were touring in England, and could you tell us the story about what happened?
Well, there's only two songs on the record that really have anything to do with that.
Yeah.
That's St. Mary and Pig.
Uh-huh.
But I had a big bottle of Valium, and apparently had been taking them real heavy on top of prescription antidepressants and stuff. So I just passed out in a hotel room in London with my legs up under me. So when I went to the hospital, and when they straightened them out, it gave me a heart attack and just a chain reaction of things shutting down in my body. So I ended up being in a London hospital for 3 months.
Mm-hmm. I read somewhere that you were, like, clinically dead for 3 minutes.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah.
I don't remember a thing.
You don't?
Uh-uh.
No. And so what was it like once you came to and realized this had happened to you and you'd lost the use of your legs?
Well, I didn't really understand what had happened for a long time. And until, I don't know, I guess I started recognizing people around me. I thought I'd had it coming for a long time.
Really?
Yeah.
In what way?
Just messing up.
Yeah.
Just being a, yeah.
Messing up in what sense?
Just doing too much of everything, overindulging in
yeah.
things.
Yeah. So it was like a warning sign?
Yeah.
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 Did you take it as this warning that you better straighten up?
Well, I took it as, it was inspirational in a way because so many people came to see me and wrote me cards and letters.
Uh-huh.
People who had the first record in it, how it affected them so much in a really good way.
Yeah.
And that sort of inspired me to get better and make more records.
What was your rehabilitation like?
I didn't really do a whole lot of it.
Yeah.
It just involved learning how to walk again, really.
Mm-hmm. And do you have complete use of your legs now at this point? Do you have to...
Yeah, I just have to wear braces on my legs.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah. And will you have to wear those braces for
yeah,
a long time?
Forever.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah. But otherwise, your health is good.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah. Well, that's good. Well, let's play one of those songs that came out of that experience. I think I'd like to hear some of Pig.
Thank you.
That's Mark Linkous, Sparkle Horse on Good Morning Spider. That's obviously a much harsher, kind of more explosively emotional piece of work than is on, you know, a lot of the rest of the CD. I hate to use that overused word cathartic, but were you working out some kind of hard emotions that you had in the wake of that accident?
Yeah, I think that was just wanting, screaming at my body, wanting my old body back.
Yeah. My guest is Mark Linkous, leader of the rock band Sparkle Horse. Let's take a short break. This is Fresh Air. We're back with Mark Linkous, the man behind Sparkle Horse. I've read that you live on a farm in Virginia. Is that where you grew up?
No, I grew up all over Virginia.
Uh-huh.
Now I live on a return to Virginia after living in New York and Los Angeles.
Uh-huh. What did your parents do?
My father's a coal miner. His father was a coal miner. My mom just worked in a factory.
Uh-huh. So when you were growing up, did you expect to become a coal miner if your father and your grandfather had been?
Yeah, I would have been.
You would have been?
Yeah.
And when did you decide you didn't want to do that?
When I saw Johnny Cash on television when I was a kid.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Can you remember that moment?
Yeah.
Was it like the old Johnny Cash show?
Yeah, he would swing around and say, "Hi, I'm Johnny Cash."
Right, yeah, at the beginning of that. That was great.
Yeah, that's what I wanted to do.
Yeah. And that was a great show because it had so many different kinds of people on it that it was like the first show where it was a country show, but he would have Bob Dylan on and lots of rock and rollers.
Yeah, it was great.
Yeah. So that's when you decided this maybe was your ticket out?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Plus seeing Thunder Road and seeing Robert Mitchum flick a cigarette in a cop's eye and the cop crashes into a tree and the car blows up. That was really inspirational too.
Johnny Cash and Robert Mitchum, you can't do better with inspirations like that, I think. Between the time when you decided you wanted to be a musician and you actually launched this career, did you hold down any jobs of any kind before? Did you,
Yeah.
What sort of work did you do?
House painting, dishwashing.
Yeah.
Chimney sweeper.
Yeah.
Tried to be a coal miner for a few minutes.
Did you?
Yeah.
Yeah. Did you? Didn't like any of them?
Oh, it was miserable.
No. Did your father like his job? I don't know any coal miner. I've never read or heard of anybody who really enjoyed that work.
I don't know. My father and my grandfather had a real, they had a real strong work ethic, which I never really understood. Maybe that's why I became a musician in the first place, just being lazy, but.
I think a lot of times artists come out of that. You know, you sort of react against your parent. You look at it, and you want to do something completely different. Looking back, do you think that was it?
No, I don't know. I know when I was growing up down in the mountains, all I wanted to do was escape. But I don't think I chose music as a rebellion or anything.
Did your parents support what you wanted to do? Did they think it was okay to pursue that?
Yeah, although they'd never understood it, really.
No. Do they understand it now?
Now that they get postcards from around the world, they sort of understand it.
Yeah. Have they ever come to any of your shows?
Yeah.
Yeah?
They just still don't understand it.
Even after seeing it and hearing it? What kind of comments do they do? Does your father have any?
Yeah, he said, "Well, I love you."
Whatever the heck you're doing, I love you. That's great. For someone who likes to work alone, do you get satisfaction from performing live? Do you like performing with other musicians in front of audiences?
Certain audiences, yeah.
Yeah,
and certain musicians.
Yeah.
When they really appreciate the slow songs.
Uh-huh.
When you can get 500, 200, 2,000 people to be totally silent.
Why is that important to you?
Just because I think that they're captivated and they understand it and they totally get it. And it's not just like a social situation where everyone's going out to drink and talk and socialize. They're really there to listen to what's going on.
Do you find it's almost kind of easy if you rev up the volume and that to get a crowd reaction, and then so that it means more to you when you have a quiet song that they respond to?
Yeah, it is easier to just be loud.
Yeah.
I think it's a lot more punk rock to play quiet and pretty these days.
Really? Yeah.
I think so.
Yeah, that's an interesting idea. Are you writing more new songs at this point?
Not lately. I've just been so busy lately, but...
Yeah, because you've been on tour.
Yeah, for a while. So hopefully yeah. I'll have a little time off and
yeah.
can write a little bit.
Yeah. Are you ever able to write on the road? Do songs come to you like images or melodies and snatches that you
yeah.
try and record in some way so that when you get back home you can...
Yeah, I do.
Yeah.
Yeah, I keep a little tape recorder and try to document whatever ideas I have and then get home and sift through them.
Yeah. Are there things that just say within the past few days that... happened to you that, you know, might pop up at some point in a song? Because it sounds to me like images come to you. The songs aren't necessarily linear lyrics, and yet they're things you're thinking about, ruminating on.
Well, the sidewalk outside, the way, I don't know, you think of bricks and concrete being so sturdy.
Uh-huh.
They're just torn up all over the place. There's little places on the crosswalks where the bricks have just sank,
mm-hmm.
you know? And I was fascinated. This dog the other day at one of the clubs, he would throw this all day and he'd chase it and bring it back to you.
The bottle cap?
Tireless.
Really?
Yeah.
And it was just some dog that was...
Just hanging. I think he belonged to the sound man.
Uh-huh. Didn't know whether you allowed dogs in at the concerts or...
Oh, yeah, we encourage animals, yeah.
Do you? Yeah. Have you ever had any animals present in concerts that have helped?
No, I wanted to get a little billy goat for the tour bus, but the tour manager wouldn't let me.
Uh-huh.
And we ate it at Denny's in Oklahoma, and sure enough, there was a trailer full of billy goats, an unsecured trailer of pygmy goats.
Outside the Denny's, we should make clear, not on the menu or
right.
Near the kitchen.
Right, in the parking lot.
Yeah. Do you like billy goats?
Not really. I just thought it would brighten things up on the tour bus a little bit.
Uh-huh. Mark Linkus, leader of the band Sparkle Horse.
Hey, Joe. Come on, Joe. Don't make that sad song any sadder than it already is. Hey, Jack, get back, get yourself together.
That's Hey Joe from the CD Good Morning Spider. Coming up, Duke Ellington's collaboration with his soloists. This is Fresh Air. Thank you. One of the great clichés about Duke Ellington's music is that he always wrote for individual soloists. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead says that's more or less true, but that more often he wrote from what his soloists improvised rather than for them. Kevin says when you understand the relationship between Ellington and his soloists, you'll know why the world celebrates his genius, not to mention his 100th birthday.
Mooch, Duke Ellington and the Orchestra in 1928 with Bubber Miley on trumpet. Miley wasn't the first to use a toilet plunger as a wah-wah mute, but he combined it with a small second mute tucked inside the horn for an even more extreme sound. Duke's trombonist Joe Nanton soon picked up on it. So did Ellington the composer, who began writing such growls into his pieces. As often with Duke, a soloist's inspiration dovetailed with his own concept. Miley's talking trumpet is stylized blues singing the way the Mooch is a stylized blues tune. Ever after, Ellington kept an ear out for some quirk of phrasing, a pet lick or a pet trick he could grab from some band member and then throw back at them as an element of a composition. The searing tone and slithery motion of alto saxophonist Johnny Hodges define the Ellington sound as much as wah-wah brass did. This is Junior Hop, 1940, where Ellington the composer bends blues form, much the way Hodges bends the notes of the melody. It's not that Ellington lacked his own ideas, but for him, the well-balanced jazz orchestra needs distinctive solo voices as well as a composer's grasp of form. But once a player's style really entered the band's sound, it stayed even after the originator moved on. When Bubber Miley left in 1929, very early, his sound was already entrenched, and his replacement, Cootie Williams, was expected to replicate it. If the understudy then developed the technique further, as Williams did, Ellington capitalized on that, too. This is Concerto for Cootie, 1940. By the 1940s, Ellington's band sound had been shaped by about a dozen players who were never all in the band at the same time. They also include Rex Stewart, Cat Anderson, Juan Teasel, and Lawrence Brown on brass, Barney Bigard, Ben Webster, and Harry Carney on reeds, and Jimmy Blanton on bass. By 1960, saxophonist Paul Gonzalez and clarinetist Jimmy Hamilton had joined the list. In a way, the sound of each of these soloists became part of the orchestra's DNA. All the ancestors were in the mature sound. In the same way, Ellington's featured numbers might reflect his development as a pianist. Dancers in Love, with bassist Junior Raglan, carries echoes of childhood finger exercises, hot 1920s stride piano, and the endless repetitions of dance rehearsals. Because Ellington's music is a collective portrait of the people who played it, it's a model to other leaders of how a working band can develop its own unique sound, assuming that band has some original stylist to begin with. To me, those who try to mimic the Ellington sound instead of using his method to find their own style really miss the point. It's like they're carrying around pictures of somebody else's family in their wallet. Rex Stewart on cornet, doing his typical knee bends on Boy Meets Horn. In recent years, Ellington has been accused of ripping off the soloists who inspired him, and also his frequent arranger and collaborator, Billy Strayhorn. It is true Duke might have shared composer credits more readily. On the other hand, he often acknowledged the contributions of his colleagues and produced a number of small group records for the key soloists under their own name. And Strayhorn's Take the A-Train was Duke's theme song for over 30 years. In any collaborative art, from painting Renaissance chapels to making movies, the person in charge usually gets the credit, and there's a good reason for that. The person in charge creates the conditions under which inspired ideas can come forth.
Kevin Whitehead is the author of New Dutch Swing. We'll conclude our celebration of the centennial of Duke Ellington's birth on Thursday when we talk with Gary Giddens, author of Visions of Jazz, The First Century. For Terry Gross, I'm Ken Tucker.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Bantam Books, publisher of Sabbath, Restoring the Sacred Rhythm of Rest by Wayne Muller, available in hardcover. This is NPR, National Public Radio.